This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatimi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم ربك سريع العقاب وإنه لغفور رحيم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another, then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who, has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that he might try you by what he has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and he is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Look at our top stories. Washington turns down Ukraine's request for a no-fly zone for Russian aircraft, saying it would potentially draw the U.S. into a direct conflict with Russia. Moscow warns suppliers of lethal weapons to Ukraine that they will be held responsible if those weapons are used against the Russian military. And Israeli forces killed two Palestinians during a pre-dawn raid on a refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. Joining us. The U.S. rejects Kiev's request for a no-fly zone for Russian aircraft over Ukraine, saying participation in such a move would be tantamount to a direct conflict with Moscow. White House spokesperson Jen Psaki says implementing a no-fly zone would be a step towards sending U.S. troops to fight Russia, which Washington does not want. This after Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky urged the West to do more to help Ukraine as heavy fighting is underway in the country's second-largest city, Kharkiv. The Ukraine president also called for an international tribunal to look into what he describes as Russia's war crimes against his country. He said Russia has so far launched around 60 rocket strikes and fired over 110 cruise missiles into Ukraine. Meanwhile, Ukraine's army claims it has slowed down the pace of Russia's advance.
The Russian occupiers have slowed down the offensive, but are still trying to build on success in some areas in the offensive against Ukraine. During the air offensive, the enemy continued to fire on military and civilian airfields, military control points, air defense facilities, important critical infrastructure, settlements, and units in defense areas.
The Ukrainian military has accused Russia of launching a missile strike on residential buildings in two cities in the country's northwest and north. Meanwhile, Ukraine's health ministry has put the number of civilian casualties at 352, including 16 children. According to the ministry, over 1,600 people have also been wounded over the past 4 days. The UN Refugee Agency says over 500,000 people have fled from Ukraine into neighboring countries, with Poland and Moldova receiving the largest group of refugees. Well, to discuss that story further, I'm now joined by Dmitry Zolotarev. He is a journalist and political commentator joining us from Irkutsk. Dmitry, thank you for joining us. Russia has established total air superiority over Ukraine, and Zelensky has urged the West to enact a no-fly zone, but Washington turned down his request, saying that the U.S. will not put any troops underground and it will not send any troops or put any troops in the air to create a no-fly zone in Ukraine. What does that say about Washington's strategy here and about the U.S.'s main intentions with regards to the conflict in Ukraine?
But it says only one thing. Washington always used the same tactic to do everything not with its own hands. Washington clashes Europe and Ukraine against Russia and absolutely stays out of this. So, which is no wonder, and that was pretty much predictable, that when the red line is crossed, Washington will stay out of this as far as it can be, as it can be, and will be. There will be a war rhetorics, war mongering about sending troops, weapons to Ukraine, and help with any measures possible. But absolutely no troops of the United States Army will be in Ukraine. That was absolutely no wonder. What I can say about what was said above, that the information from the Ukrainian side about hundreds civilian casualties, including 16 children, most likely is a lie, which and a false flag, which they try to hang from the Ukrainian side among civilians and children. That's it. And maybe Ukraine, and that was established firmly, that sometimes Ukraine was shelling its own outskirts of the cities, causing casualties among civilians, just to stage a false flag situation. That's what I wanted to say.
Right. In your estimation, when will the conflict end?
Well, I'm not a clear warrant. Well, I don't know. Which is absolutely clear that Ukrainian side and Ukraine's masters from the West are trying to slow down the advance of Russian forces, trying to settle down the negotiation process, and they're trying to slow the negotiation process. They don't want peace. They want slowing down. They want bloodshed. That's what they want. They want more bloodshed, more false flag to hang it around Russian necks, and just one purpose. They do realize that Russia won't allow Zelensky to stay and Nazi, Ukrainian Nazi government to stay longer, and as a government of Ukraine. And they know for sure that Russia will do anything in its power to free Ukraine of Nazism, and you know what I mean. Zelensky understands that pretty well, and that's why they're trying to slow the whole process.
Dmitry, harsh sanctions have been imposed on Russia. NATO is sending military equipment to Ukraine. What are the chances of the conflict spilling over to other countries now?
Absolutely none. Absolutely no chance the Ukrainian conflict can split over another country. And they send weapons and equipment to Ukraine. Well, how? With automobile transport? Let me just ask them. This is minuscule, first of all. Second of all, it's not equipment, it's not weapons that fight. They have no one to fight in Ukraine. They have Nazis, which don't have motivation to fight. They have high motivation to kill at will, to kill for free, and they have a high motivation to rob. That's what they have. They don't have any motivation to fight. So this is absolutely laughable, sending those weapons and equipment there. At one hand, in the other hand, it only confirms that they don't want this conflict to stop. That the first thing to do to stop this conflict is stop supporting Ukrainian government. Mm-hmm. And in no time, they would surrender, just in no time. Should Europe and the United States say, we don't support you anymore in any way, the conflict stops without any further bloodshed.
Right.
That's it. So if Europe imposes more deadly sanctions against Russia, which is financial war and actually acts of serious aggression against Russia. If they send troops to Ukraine, if they take Ukraine to European Union, well, then we'll see. There is a possibility the war would splash on some other territories, but the hopes are high and chances very minuscule of this scenario.
Dmitry, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time. I've been talking to Dmitry Zolotarev. He's a journalist and political commentator who just joined us from Irkutsk. Moving on. Russia has closed its airspace to airlines from dozens of countries in response to sanctions targeting its aviation sector. All 27 European Union nations, as well as Britain and Canada, are among the 36 countries barred from using the Russian airspace. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has canceled a trip to the United Nations office in Geneva due to the airspace ban imposed by several EU countries. The Russian Foreign Ministry says the steps the European Union has taken against Moscow will not go without a harsh response. It added that those supplying lethal weapons to Ukraine will bear responsibility should they be used during Russia's military campaign there. Meanwhile, China has declared its opposition to anti-Russia sanctions.
China's position on the Ukraine issue is consistent. China always decides its position and policy based on the merits of the matter. China does not approve the use of sanctions to solve problems, and even more opposed to unilateral sanctions that have no basis in international law. Practice has long proven that sanctions will not solve problems, but create new ones. This will not only result in a lose-lose or losing all-side situation in the economy, but also interfere with the process of political settlement.
The Chinese official said his country's relationship with Russia has not targeted any third country. He stressed that Beijing and Moscow remain strategic partners. Russia has been targeted by several rounds of Western sanctions over its military operations in Ukraine. The bans mainly target Russia's banks and economic sector, as well as individuals, including President Vladimir Putin. The UK says Western sanctions are designed to topple Putin, but the West does not seek anything in terms of regime change. Moscow says it is able to ride out the sanctions. In its latest anti-Moscow move, Washington has expelled 12 Russian diplomats at the United Nations, labeling them as intelligence operatives. Russia's UN ambassador says Moscow will respond to the move because, quote, it's diplomatic practice. We've asked political commentator Sarah Flounders for her opinion on how the escalation of tensions eventually resulted in Russia taking military action against Ukraine. Here's her analysis of the situation.
I think we have to start with what U.S. commanded NATO forces have done for years to instigate as a provocateur, to light the fuse in what's happening now in the Ukraine. And it was the aggressive coup of an elected government that overturned and brought in a fascist force that aligned with NATO. And even though Ukraine is not officially a member of NATO, it has become a de facto member because U.S. arms are being pumped in, U.S. advisors, and on that 1,200-mile border between Ukraine and Russia, there are all kinds of weapons being put in place, including missiles, SAM and Stinger missiles, and weaponized drones. Along with U.S. advisors, there have been 14,000 civilian casualties in eastern Ukraine, in the Donbas region. So even now, as the media is reporting, some 350 civilian casualties in the rest of Ukraine on the Russian advance, we just have to know that those 8 years and thousands, 14,000 civilian casualties, that is what lit the spark.
In a phone call with his French counterpart, Russia's President Vladimir Putin has set out several conditions for the resolution of the conflict with Ukraine. According to a Kremlin readout, Putin said Kiev should be neutral, denazified, and demilitarized, and that Russia's control over Crimea should be formally recognized. The Russian leader said Moscow was open to talks with representatives of Ukraine and expects the negotiations to lead to the desired results. In turn, Emmanuel Macron reiterated the international community's demand that Russia halt its offensive in Ukraine. Macron also urged Putin to stop all strikes on civilians, preserve civilian infrastructure, and provide safe access to key routes, especially south of Kiev. According to the Elysee Palace, Putin confirmed his willingness to commit on these 3 points. Israeli forces have carried out a deadly raid on a Palestinian refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. Israeli troops opened fire on people in Jenin camp, killing two of them. Palestinian security sources have identified the first victim as Abdullah Hosari, a former prisoner held by Israel. Hours later, a second man who'd been shot in the head died of his injury. Earlier, Israeli forces attacked Palestinians who had gathered to celebrate a Muslim holiday, injuring dozens of them. Israel occupied Al-Quds along with the rest of the West Bank in 1967 and considers the entire city as its capital. But Palestinians want the West Bank as part of their future independent Palestinian state, with East Al-Quds as its capital. Iran's UN ambassador calls for an international collective response to harmonize regulations on fighting cybercrime. Majid Tahrawanchi says standardized operating procedures are needed to stop the malicious crimes committed via the use of information and communications technology. He highlighted the importance of creating a UN cybercrime convention with constructive engagement of all members. He said the convention should make sure that the signatories respect the fundamental principles of international law, namely territorial integrity and non-intervention in domestic affairs of other states. Iran's envoy said the convention should forbid its members from taking unilateral coercive measures. He said it should also prohibit each member from undermining the ability of others to fight cybercrimes, which are constantly changing. Iran says it's been the victim of repeated cyber attacks. Well, with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
The glorious day of Mab'ath. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Salam, everybody, and heartiest congratulations to you all on the advent of the occasion that changed the destiny of the world. Today is that joyous day when over a millennium and four centuries ago, the Archangel Gabriel descended by God's command on Mount Nur on the outskirts of the then obscure town of Mecca in the Arabian Peninsula with the following divine message to a 40-year-old person popularly known as As-Sadiq, or the truthful, and Al-Amin, or the trustworthy. Read in the name of your Lord who created man from a clod. Read, and your Lord is most honorable, who taught to write with the pen, taught man what he knew not. The moment Archangel Gabriel brought these ayahs to the person whose light was the first thing created by God Almighty, calm and confident as ever, as the recipient of the message, he recited these ayahs as if he knew it more perfectly than the conveyor of the message. What transpired on the 27th of the month of Rajab at Cave Hira, exactly 1,455 lunar years ago, was that glorious moment which would change the destiny of the world. This was the start of the gradual revelation for the next 23 years of the Noble Quran, which remains till this day as the immortal miracle of Islam. Please stay with us for a special feature in this regard. It was indeed the dawn of the universal message of Islam, the message of monotheism that was conveyed to the various nations of the world in bits and parts by the previous prophets, whose missions were time-bound and confined to particular geographical areas, was now being entrusted to the one who is undoubtedly the best of creation. It was now the duty of the 40-year-old messenger of mercy to not just expound it to the humanity of his era, but to entrust it to a line of trustees that never veer for a moment from the straight and unwavering path of God. No wonder Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, had said in explicit terms, "I was the prophet, then Adam was still in the uncreated state between water and clay." To doubt the words of the person whose truthfulness the Almighty verifies in the opening ayahs of Surah Najm by saying, "He neither errs nor speaks out of desire, but it is revelation which is revealed," is outright blasphemy. Doesn't God also say in Ayah 107 of Surah Anbiya in the Noble Quran, "We have not sent him but as a mercy to the creation"? As a matter of fact, Mab'ath, which signifies resurgence, is the most important day on which the sun has ever shone. It is the resurgence of not just humanitarian values, but the basic purpose of life and the goal towards which mankind is moving. Hence, it is more significant than the creation of Adam and the start of the human race. It is more memorable than the miraculous transformation into a pleasant garden of the huge fire the tyrant Nimrod had lit up and hurled Prophet Abraham into it. It is more important than the parting of the sea waters for Prophet Moses, peace upon him, to allow him safe passage from the oppression of the Pharaoh. It is more precious than the miraculous virgin birth of Prophet Jesus, peace upon him, without the association of any male for his mother, the virtuous Mary, peace upon her. In other words, Mab'ath is not a spontaneous occurrence in the barren landscape of the Arabian Peninsula. On the contrary, it is the highest watermark in history that separates truth from falsehood, virtue from vices, and right from wrong, for which mankind was being prepared through a long and unbroken chain of divine messengers spanning different eras and various geographical regions in order to build the mindset for the single universal message, Islam. A glance at the state of humanity before and after the proclamation of Islam confirms this point. That is why the pre-Islamic society, not just of Arabia, but also of the supposedly civilized nations of the past, is called Jahiliya, or the Age of Ignorance. Time and space do not allow us to go into details, but even a cursory glance at the cultures of the past reveals that despite their pretensions to power and material achievements, they sorely lacked such basic humanitarian fundamentals as monotheism or faith in the one and only Creator, equality of all human beings without any distinction of color, race, language, and class, social justice as the privilege of each and every individual, including those adhering to other beliefs, women's right to own property, marry according to their will, safeguard their honor and individuality through observing of modesty and hijab that none is entitled to violate, compassion, forgiveness, generosity, truthful speech that are so instrumental in promoting peace and fraternity, refusal to bow to oppression, and last but not the least, rationality that not only negates superstitions but grants the freedom of education to all, thereby ruling out manipulation of science and knowledge by vested interests. Thus, the marking of Mab'ath means the renewal of allegiance to all such egalitarian principles that make a true Muslim and lead to the building of the real monolithic Islamic Ummah, which Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, preached through practical demonstration, and which the present Muslim world has largely neglected to its own detriment. No doubt, the universal mission of Prophet of Islam was foretold in all heavenly scriptures, ranging from the Book of Abraham to the Torah of Moses and the Evangel of Jesus, as well as in the religious texts of the Zoroastrians, the Hindus, the Buddhists, and other cultures. The skeptics are advised to read the passages in the Book of Deuteronomy, the Gospel of St. John, the Avesta, and the Prunas for confirmation of the universal mission of the last and greatest prophet. This means the 27th of Rajab is the day of formal divine appointment of the mercy to the entire creation. But who was the first and foremost person to bear testimony to the mission of the man who pronounced that fundamental article of monotheistic faith, Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah, which means, I testify there is no God but Allah? The answer is obvious. It was his cousin, ward, and divinely designated heir, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, who witnessed the glorious event of Rajab 27th on Mount Nur, and who, as a 10-year boy, completed the Kalima, or testimony of faith, that every Muslim recites till this day by saying, Ashhadu anna Muhammadan Rasulullah, which means, I testify Muhammad is the messenger of Allah. In Sermon 191 of the famous book Nahjul Balagha, Imam Ali, peace upon him, informs us, when the revelation descended on the Prophet of Allah, I heard the moan of Satan. I asked, O Prophet of Allah, what is this moan? He replied, this is Satan who has lost all hope of being worshipped. O Ali, you see all that I see and you hear all that I hear, except that you are not a prophet, but you are a vicegerent. That is the reason it is highly recommended to perform the ziyarat of Imam Ali, peace upon him, whether from afar or near his holy shrine in Najaf on the day of Mab'ath. Those still in doubt are advised to go through the contents of the miracle of the Prophet, the fathomless treasure, true of wisdom, that is the noble Quran, which confirms in Ayah 43 of Surah Ra'd the position in celestial hierarchy of the person who was considered Quran-e-Natiq, or the living Quran. And those who disbelieve say, you have not been sent as prophet. Say, O Muhammad, Allah is sufficient as a witness between me and you, and he who has knowledge of the book.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello and welcome to the latest installment of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. I'm your host, Robert Carter. This week, we'll examine the Zionist-led attack on higher education in the UK and beyond. We'll focus on the attempt to remove voices critical of settler colonialism in British universities and on one key occasion that has done more than many to harass and intimidate universities, the Community Security Trust. As always, we'll be joined by expert guests to delve into the background of Israel's ethnic cleansing and explore what can be done about it. But first, Bianca Rahimi gets us started with this special report on the innocent-sounding Community Security Trust.
Why are academics from the United States to Britain being chased out of their jobs for standing with the Palestinians? From Stephen Salater to Cornel West, outspoken and high-profile university lecturers shunned from their positions are bitterly complaining about the influence of the Israel lobby. One of the most notable scalps claimed in Britain was our own resident expert, Professor David Miller of the University of Bristol, who was sacked in October 2021. But where did the bid to oust him come from? The years-long smear campaign against David Miller began with a UK charity named the Community Security Trust. But what is the CST and who exactly is behind it? The Community Security Trust was created in 1994, and its explicit aim is to campaign against anti-Semitism. Based in North London, critics have long charged that it deliberately blurs the distinction between anti-Semitism and criticism of Israel. The CST is run by the convicted fraudster and supporter of Netanyahu, Gerald Ronson. At the time of its founding, Ronson was a board member of the Israel lobby group, BICOM. So close to the Israeli government is Ronson that when serving jail time for fraud, he was phoned by serving Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir. Ronson and two other founding trustees of the CST were central to the United Jewish Israel Appeal, a UK fundraising vehicle described as one of Israel's national institutions. His charity of the Gerald and Gail Ronson Family Foundation has pledged over £4 million to the Jerusalem Foundation, which builds for settlers in East Jerusalem. A scanning of Ronson's memoirs reveals he prides himself on being good with his fists and holds Islamophobic views. Today, the CST works hard to give a more civilized impression. The Community Security Trust is lavished with funding by the British government. In 2012, Education Secretary Michael Gove allocated £2 million of public money to the CST, despite simultaneously sitting on the organization's advisory board. In fact, the CST receives millions in funding from the government every year. In April 2020, the Home Office gave the CST £14 million. The Home Secretary at the time was Priti Patel, who had famously had to resign in 2017 over unauthorized secret meetings with Israeli officials about directing public funds to the Zionist entity. While the CST claims it does not lobby for the Israeli regime, the evidence begs to differ, as the usurping entity fostered the idea of anti-Zionism as a new anti-Semitism. The CST has echoed that call consistently. According to Anthony Lerman, the director of the Institute of Jewish Policy Research, who previously worked very closely with the CST, Israel's external intelligence oversaw the regime's campaigns against anti-Semitism in the early 2000s. Lerman also asserts that CST staff have been trained by Israeli intelligence. One of the long-running criticisms of the organization has been that despite claims it protects the Jewish community, it actually targets some Jews as a threat. Left-wing Jews and those critical of Israel have been forcibly removed from meetings. One of the CST activities seems to be the creating of extensive files on critics of Israel. It was exposed that the CST submitted to the British Home Office a list of anti-Zionist Jews that it defined as extremists. The CST were also involved in working for a change in the law on universal jurisdiction, which protects war criminals of the Israeli regime from UK arrest. The organization was also on the executive committee of the Fair Play Campaign Group, a joint anti-BDS initiative of several Israel lobby groups. From 2003, the CST, with other pro-Israel groups, advised the Israeli regime's Coordination Forum for Monitoring Anti-Semitism. This produced a concerted effort to lobby for a definition of anti-Semitism that would assist them in censoring and then attempting to criminalize anti-Zionism and criticism of Israel more generally. This process ended with the adoption in 2016 of the International Holocaust Remembrance Association Working Definition of Anti-Semitism, a definition which prohibits identification of the racist nature of Zionism. This is the weapon of choice now being deployed against universities. The CST was behind the original complaint against Professor Miller at the University of Bristol. When that was rebuffed, the CST approached the Union of Jewish Students, with which it had a very close relationship, and the UJS put in a complaint as a result. The avalanche against David Miller consisted of parliamentarians and even a direct intervention serving housing minister with links to Israeli intelligence, Robert Jenrick. Despite being cleared by a Bristol University investigation of any form of anti-Semitism, David Miller was fired as the university administration crumbled under the pressure. As the victims of this witch hunt struggle to repair their lives and fight for their livelihoods, the question must be asked: why is an organization founded by a lobbyist for a foreign regime with staff trained by a foreign intelligence service being funded by the British taxpayer? And why is it attempting to dictate who can and who can't teach in British universities?
To discuss the Community Security Trust and the forces behind it, we're joined today by two guests. Chris Williamson is the former Labour MP for Derby North and a well-known campaigner for socialism and Palestinian rights. Chris was a Shadow Communities and Home Office Minister under Ed Miliband and Jeremy Corbyn. But since leaving Parliament in 2019, Chris has founded the Resist Movement for a People's Party and established the Left Legal Fighting Fund. He's also joined by our regular programme expert, David Miller, who is an academic and former professor at Bristol University and co-director of the lobbying watchdog initiative, Spinwatch. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. Now, David, I'm going to start off with you because this is obviously quite personal for you. The CST were, of course, involved, as we've heard from Bianca, in your case regarding your job at Bristol University. Could you just tell us a little bit about what that was like and what they were up to in the whole affair?
Well, I'd been at Bristol University for only a few months when I did a lecture on Islamophobia, in which I discussed my writing on Islamophobia, in particular the role of the Zionist movement, parts of the Zionist movement, in encouraging Islamophobia. And the CST complained about the lecture to the university and said that I was defaming the CST and that what I was saying was quite wrong. The university rejected the complaint because the CST doesn't have any basis to make complaints. You have to be a student to make a complaint. And they couldn't get any students to complain about me, so they approached the Union of Jewish Students and they had them put in a complaint, and they recruited for that the head of the Jewish Society at Bristol to do that. Now, these complaints were eventually rejected, but there was a two-year campaign following this by the CST, by the UJS, and by a whole range of Israel lobby groups, far too many to mention, who consistently argued for me to be sacked. And that culminated in the end in a second investigation of me in February 2021, which eventually resulted in me being sacked in October 21. So there was a long period, almost 3 years, of a concerted attack on me. And the interesting thing about the CST's role here is it goes back a lot further than that 2 to 3 year campaign to my first interactions with the CST, when I was an expert witness called for the defense of a Palestinian politician called Sheikh Raed Salah, who was being deported. The Home Office were trying to deport him. And they were trying to deport him based on evidence the CST had provided to the Home Office. And in the course of the proceedings, we got to see this evidence. And amongst other misinformation in there, the CST had provided to the Home Office a translation of a poem by Salah in which the word oppressors had been mistranslated to Jews. And so you could see that there was a process there of misinformation, which comes from the files that the CST maintains. It's in part a spy agency. And when I was involved in that case, I revealed what the CST was up to, and they lost the case, and Sheikh Salah was not deported. And so ever since then, this is back in 2011, they've had an animus against me, and they didn't forget that.
Now, Chris, you were obviously involved in your own dispute within the Labour Party regarding the anti-Semitism scandals and so on, the witch hunt, as it's been described by you and some of your allies, if you like. How did the CST play a role in all that?
Well, the CST and the UGS actually had a really pernicious influence, I think, on the Labour Party and led the witch hunt. I mean, I was smeared on a relatively regular basis, both by the CST, a so-called charity, and the Union of Jewish Students as well. And there was an organised campaign to no-platform me at universities. Various university bodies, as a result of lobbying by the UGS, and no doubt having reference as well to the CST, were then actually joining in the smears. So there was a kind of real momentum built up behind the attacks that were being levelled against me by the CST and the UGS. And that was essentially because I was speaking up for Palestinian rights and ironically defending anti-Zionist left-wing Jewish comrades who had been suspended from the Labour Party.
Now, David, obviously Michael Gove's relationship with the CST as well is indicative of the wider embrace of pro-Israel organisations by politicians. Perhaps you could go into that, because Michael Gove isn't the only politician that's linked to the CST and their activities.
Well, one of the things that I discovered in doing this research back in 2011 on the CST was their secret list of advisors, which they don't publicise. I was able to find this online. It had been put online inadvertently, and I was able to find this. And amongst the advisors was Michael Gove, but many other politicians on there as well, and indeed many former and current senior police officers on there too. And we were able to point out then that when Michael Gove gave millions of pounds to the CST, that he had a conflict of interest, which should have meant that he had excluded himself from the decision-making process. The Home Office didn't seem to mind about that. But Gove is a very interesting character. He is, of course, I suppose, one of the best-known neoconservatives in this country, and he is ferociously pro-Israel. That's one of the people at the heart of government who have been very key in promoting the interests of lobby groups like the CST. There are others too. I mean, as it was mentioned in the film, Priti Patel, was of course had to resign over secret meetings with the Israelis, including meetings in the occupied Golan Heights, where she was talking about the need to send UK aid money not to the Palestinians but to the IDF. For their activities in the Golan Heights. Truly extraordinary thing to say. So, yeah, of course, there are many politicians who have the ear of the Israel lobby and who will do their bidding.
And I think what's also interesting is a lot of these politicians, Michael Gove, Priti Patel, they've also been accused of Islamophobia. Michael Gove has actually written some texts regarding his views on Islam, which are considered Islamophobic, to say the least. And they also coincidentally are pro-Israel in the same right. But before we go on to that, let me ask you about this group's link to Bristol University, because I believe you have something to say on that as well.
Well, I mean, the CST complained in March 2019, but it's since come to light that the Gail and Gerald Ronson Family Foundation, which is run by the head of the CST, Gerald Ronson, gave money to the University of Bristol in 2011, 2017, 2018. And as a result, the foundation became part of the Vice-Chancellor's Circle, which is a kind of elite, exclusive club for people to engage with the Vice-Chancellor. Now, we have no evidence that there was any direct relationship between this funding and the pressure to sack me, but it certainly is the case that that there were many people who give funding to the university who called for me to be sacked. I'm aware of this from the internal evidence that there isn't on the matter. So it's an issue, I think, that which could be looked at, but which has not been previously discussed by anyone or noticed indeed by anyone.
Now, Chris, David Miller is an academic, one of many that's been targeted by groups like the CST. You're of a politician background, political background. You as well have claimed that the CST, among others, have gone after you. Another politician that has been gone after in a very similar way is Jeremy Corbyn, very well known internationally, the former leader of the Labour Party. Has the CST played any role against him? And if so, could you just elaborate on what they've been up to?
Yes, they have. And I think Jeremy's response and the leadership in general's response, leadership of the Labour Party's response to these accusations actually fed them and made matters worse, because Jeremy continued to, you know, backtrack and to apologise for nothing, frankly. He had nothing to apologise about. Jeremy's record on fighting bigotry and racism is, you know, second to none. But the problem was that the default position was that whenever there was an accusation of anti-Semitism, the Labour Party backed down, capitulated, and the unit that was charged, the so-called governance and legal unit, with, as it were, administering the disciplinary process in the Labour Party, they had a special unit dealing with anti-Semitism, and the go-to source for information about anti-Semitism was the CST, in particular Dave Rich, who is the head of policy at the CST. And they obviously conflate anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism. The Labour Party adopted the IHRA working definition, and all these things coming together resulted in a situation where people were being systematically thrown under the bus. Jeremy Corbyn's strongest supporters, basically, you know, left-wing, anti-racist, pro-Palestinian socialists, were being thrown under the bus on a systematic basis. And the real problem was that people, as I say, charged with dealing with disciplinary matters inside the Labour Party, were looking to a body which has clearly made that conflation. And even the General Secretary, they were besotted by the CST. And little wonder, therefore, we ended up in a situation where ultimately, you know, the Labour Party and that whole move, that whole so-called Corbyn project, that drive towards a transformational socialist programme in the country, was consumed by this. And that, in no small measure, a lot of people have said Labour lost the election in 2019 because of Brexit. That was obviously a factor. But another one that hasn't got, I think, the attention that it deserves is this capitulation to false anti-Semitism slurs. What the leadership should have done, what the party should have done, is to stand up to them and talk about Jeremy's record, talk about the Labour Party record, talk about the people that were being targeted, particularly, as I say, left-wing Jews. I mean, some of the people that were targeted were the children of Holocaust survivors, the children of Auschwitz, people, their parents had survived Auschwitz. It was an absolute scandal, a disgrace. And it destroyed Jeremy Corbyn, it destroyed the Corbyn project, and I believe led directly to the election of a right-wing government of Boris Johnson.
And Chris, I want to ask you about this point as well. It was mentioned in part in Bianca's report earlier in the show. The CST claim that they're about fighting anti-Semitism wherever it is, raising alarm bells. But right now in the Labour Party, it's actually left-wing socialist Jewish members which are being kicked out, booted out, accused of being anti-Semitic, if I'm not mistaken. Perhaps you could elaborate that point.
Yes, indeed. I mean, that gives a lie to the assertion by the CST that they're concerned about anti-Semitism. The reality is they're concerned about people exposing, calling out Zionism. Because what we're now seeing is, as you say, left-wing Jewish members of the Labour Party are being thrown out on a systematic basis. And indeed, an organisation called the Jewish Voice for Labour has done some number crunching. And they have worked out that if you're a member of the JVL, I think you're 4 or 5 times more likely to be expelled or suspended from the Labour Party. If you're a committee member of the Jewish Voice for Labour, I think they worked out there's something like 150 or 200 times more likely to be disciplined, suspended and expelled from the Labour Party. It's an absolute disgrace. It's a travesty, frankly, a travesty of justice. And, you know, it's... I think the way in which the party, the leadership of the party, capitulated to these false slurs has opened the floodgates. It's led directly to people like esteemed academics, like Professor David Miller here, being targeted, and others are being targeted as well. And that's why I think, you know, there could be no compromise, in my opinion, and this is what I was arguing for inside the Labour Party at the time, and pleading with Jeremy and socialist members of the Parliamentary Labour Party to draw a line in the sand and to fight back and speak up for Jeremy's reputation, for the party's reputation, for their own reputation, because they were also being demonised by these despicable slurs which are being levelled against people who spent their life fighting racism.
And David, you're of course one of those individuals who did draw a line in the sand. You continued to talk about Israel and crimes against the Palestinians, the issues with Zionism and the Israel lobby and its activities in the UK and elsewhere. And of course you've been persecuted for that, as you've put it in your own words in the past. But surely you've mentioned this to the university at the time when they were investigating and so on. And there are many other groups which have mentioned and complained about this type of issue, issues with groups like the CST and so on. What was the university's response? Because surely they were being told, look, don't trust what groups like the CST are telling you about you, about others. What do they know what's going on?
I think there's a sort of naivety in the universities in general in relation to these kinds of issues. I mean, there have been many issues, some of which are not all in the public domain, but Warwick University, Glasgow University, Birmingham, there's been a number of other universities who've had similar sorts of issues come up. We've heard recently about the case of Sheffield Hallam University. I think that the problem is that that universities aren't really familiar with the politics of this. They've been browbeaten into adopting the IHRA definition by the government and by the lobby. And as a result, people who don't have a good grounding in Palestinian human rights campaigning, when they look at the IHRA, they don't really understand how they're supposed to interpret it, and they interpret it in a way which results in perfectly legal, lawful, not anti-Semitic speech being effectively criminalised. And so there's a kind of naivety there. And when you point this out to people, well, they look at you a little bit strangely. They don't understand that this is actually a lobby campaign, which is, you know, which is as is well known, really, directed from Israel. I mean, the CST was involved very, very early on with the Israeli government in the process which led to the IHRA. The IHRA didn't come from nowhere. It came from Israel lobby groups putting onto the agenda and having it agreed. And so what you have is a hostile foreign power, the Israeli government, trying to intervene in politics, first in the Labour Party and now in the universities, and indeed in many other places as well. And the weapon of choice, as was said in the report, is the IHRA definition. So the problem is that the universities don't really get that, and until and unless we are able to reverse the IHRA adoption in universities, we will see many more people who are disciplined or thrown from their jobs or denied appointments, etc. And that's the difficulty with this whole process, is that the universities roll over, not necessarily because of an ideological commitment to Zionism, but because they don't really know what they're doing.
And, you know, it's interesting that you say that, because a hostile foreign government intervening in British politics, in British education system and so on via these groups. Imagine if, let's say, the Russians were doing that, for example. It'd be a massive nationwide story, international headlines spinning around. But because it's Israel, it's a colonialist ally, if you like, it seems to be totally ignored. In fact, there could even be some cooperation, in fact, from Westminster, as you mentioned. But very briefly, before the show ends, perhaps you could just tell us what you think could or should be done to try and combat against this smear machinery that's going
on. Well, I mean, the unions, the UCU, the University College Union, could do much more than it has done. In some places, it's been very good. In the case of Sheffield Hallam recently, it's been very good. And that's one thing. But the other thing is, of course, that many of these organisations, including the Community Security Trust, are charities, and they are supposed to exist for public benefit. And it's clear that in some of their activities, the activities we've been outlining, they're not acting for public benefit. They're acting in the interest of, a hostile foreign power. And it's about time that the Charity Commission started to take note of this. There are many, many pro-Israel groups in this country, hundreds of them, which are charities, and many of them are effectively violating their own charitable charters. And that's something which, in the fullness of time, I hope to see pushback on, and that the Charity Commission is forced into not allowing activities which are, in effect, collaborating with breaches of international law.
Sure. Well, gentlemen, unfortunately, we are out of time for this edition of the programme, but I'm sure we'll have you back very, very soon, Chris. And David, we'll see you next time for sure. And hopefully we'll see you at home back joining us on the next edition of Palestine Declassified. Until next time, it's bye for now.
In the limelight.
It is crystal clear that NATO has badly blundered. A military organization that had no justification to exist following the end of Cold War in 1991 and the dismantling of its socialist rival, the Warsaw Pact. Its dream of eastward expansion to the borders of Russia might finally lead to its own demise. Dear listeners, this was part of an article.